Okay, today is Monday, November 7th, 2011, and once again I say hello to the students in front of me and to the many that are listening across the universe. In relation to yesterday's share, I just want to say that my thesis on Kabbalah and the Nova Yehuda, I recalled afterwards at night, the Nova Yehuda has, we were discussing yesterday in class, the influence the Kabbalah has in the Halacha. And if someone allows the Kabbalah to influence the Halacha, does that mean he's a Mekubal or not? So I showed the students that recently a doctorate was done on the Nova Yehuda by a professor, Sharon Flatto, if I recall the name. Actually, I recognize the name. That may be the family that Lo Aleinu, one daughter was killed down south. I taught two of her sisters, as I recall. And she takes the thesis that the Nova Yehuda and some of his cohorts were Mekubalim. And I disagree. I mean, the Rav, and I told the class, there was a whole article on the Rav, whether or not he was Mekubal or not after the Rav died. And of course the Rav cited Kabbalah, but it doesn't mean he was Mekubal. And whatever it was, I gave my thesis yesterday, which I stand on. It's no different than any other Achron. But it dawned upon me, the Noda B'Yehuda has the strongest Tshuva ever that was written against saying L'Shem Yichud Kudsha Brichu. And in that tshuva, he rips the heck out of the Hasidim. I dealt with it years ago when I dealt with the history of Hasidut and opposition. So it strengthens my case. But I would, you know, one day if I come across Sharon Flatow's doctorate, I'll look at it and see if she quotes that tshuva and how she handles it. Now, in relation to the chief rabbinate in Tel Aviv in 1935, I'm holding in front of me a Xerox copy, enlarged a little bit for my eyes, of the letters of Reb Chaim Isaac Wyszynski to the Chazon Ish. And it's found, again, I know that this was republished in Igrot Achiezer. Igrot Achiezer are the letters of the Chazon Ish. Why was it called Achiezer? Because his Shelet and Shivet are called Shivet Achiezer. But I'm quoting from the first time it appeared in Kovitz Sigaret to the Chazon Ish, Chelek Sheni, or Kovitz Sigaret by the Chazon Ish, Chelek Sheni, Ubisofen Ilvak Tzat Mi Igrot Maran Hagon Reb Chaim Isaac Zatzal, and I'm quoting from Letter Chet, written in 1935, and it's exactly as I remembered. Reb Chaim Isaac writes to the Chazon Ish, I want to inform you that the rabbinate in Tel Aviv is up for election, and lahasharati nachon ma'od lefi amatzav lechot harav agon malachu kvodo harav, and then their dots, and that's where the Rav went. Fill in my name, Yosef Dov Halevi Soloveitchik, and I want to show you what strengthens my thesis that the Rav was not wrong. And Rabbi Shlomo Pick, in quoting the family of the Chazon Ish, the Greinemann family, but never having seen the letter, I can't accept it until I see the letter. K'medumeh shehu ha-mevchon mikol ha-kanadachim she-shamati ulam ha-davei talui ba-hadruchot ha-shorerot b'dat ha-kila asher bevadai titein mishpat ha-ktima l'mizrachi bolet. And in other words, what is Reb Chaim Moser saying? Yeah, and correctly so. Reb Chaim Moser was the leading respondent, Talmud Chacham, but also the leading political leader of Lithuanian Torah. And he had the political insight. You cannot force a chief rabbi on a community. And he uses the words that I am positive they will choose a candidate who is a Mizrahi Bolet. What does it mean, a Mizrahi Bolet? Someone who seemingly, totally, completely identifies with the Mizrahi movement. And of course, the Rav was not a Mizrahi Bolet, but I don't think on Rav Kahaneman, you could even have a Havimina that he was a Mizrahist. He was totally in the yeshiva world, totally, as far as I understand, in the aguda world, that he was more open-minded than most, goes without saying, and that he was involved in the revolution against the Musa movement in his youth goes without saying, and I didn't need Reb Nosson Kamenetsky to teach me that in the making of a gadol, because I know that from the stories I heard when I learned in Lakewood. So that he was individualistic goes without saying. But about the Rav, you could say he was not a Mizrahi Bolet. He had gone to Berlin. He was involved, semi-involved with Aguda. He certainly was more open-minded, and he had a PhD. But a Mizrahi Bolet, compared to Rav Amiel, he certainly wasn't. So anyway, looking at the original letter again just strengthens my feeling. And until the Greinemann family is willing to show the original letter, I regret that I was shot down by Rav Shlomo Pick, and I accepted his emendation. And I want it made known that I feel bad that I doubted my Rebbe. And if he banged with his hand and said, fill in the name Yosef Dov Halevi Soloveitchik, Daniel, why are you sitting so far back? I will accept that as authoritative. Now, we spoke last week about how Aguda was organized, what the idea behind it was. We spoke about World War I that intervened, and finally in 1919, Aguda got off the ground, and they made certain basic decisions that affect Aguda until today. Number one, that the rabbis will have the ultimate authority on every issue. The Balabatim can decide what colors to paint the wall, but anything beyond that, the rabbis will have a say, and that ultimately evolved into a concept of Das Torah that we will deal with in great detail down the line. The second decision, of course, that there could be no sovereignty in the state of Israel until Mashiach Tzidkenu. And just think what that means, no sovereignty in the state of Israel until Mashiach Tzidkenu. That the Jews are not entitled to come here, the Jews are not entitled to have authority to rule. The Jews can live here, but they can't claim sovereignty. Okay, and then they planned for the Knessia Gedola. I want to pick up where I left off in 1923 in Vienna. I explained to you Vienna, after World War I, became a tremendous center of Torah. What happened was that a lot of the Galician Jews, even some of the Hungarian Jews, moved to Vienna, even Polish Jews, they wanted to escape the ravages of the battlefield of World War I. Vienna was relatively safe, and even the biggest rebbeim, many of the greatest rebbeim from the Rishina dynasty, or what you say in English, the Rishina dynasty, Yiddish it's Rishina, in Hebrew it's Rishon. Many of the greatest rabbeim of the Rishina dynasty wound up in Vienna. It had become a center of Torah, and Vienna was more or less centrally located. The Hasidic rabbeim could come in, the Litvish Resh Yeshiva could come in, and the Yekesh Rabbanim. And in 1923, 900 delegates descended upon Vienna, and you had your first Knessia Gedola. The word Knessia Gedola actually comes from the Gemara, and it's fancy Aramaic for Kenes Gadol. This becomes very historic. You have a Knessia Gedola 1923 in Vienna. You have a Knessia Gedola 1929 in Vienna. You have a Knessia Gedola in Marienbad, Czechoslovakia 1937, which will spend it becomes very important to us as sitting in this classroom and of Anglo origins, you'll see why. The next Knessia Gedola is in Yerushalayim 1954, 1964. The last and perhaps the final Knessia Gedola we will see before Mashiach Tzidkenu was 1980. And one of the participants in that Knessia Gedola coming in with the card of a reporter of representing Jewish life from the United States was a guy named Ani Rothkopf, a.k.a. Aaron Rakefet. Now, the Knessia Gedola becomes very important for the reason I said to you, strength in numbers. It was overwhelming. 900 frum Jews, Rabbanim, activists, come together. The Chofetz Chaim, 84 years of age, came to Knessia and gave Birchat Kohanim. And I have to tell you, we sitting in this classroom, what we wouldn't give, imagine to have seen the Chofetz Chaim and to get Birchat Kohanim from the Chofetz Chaim. I don't have to minimize it. We have to feel it. Shimon Peres is president of Israel. The man, every time he opens his mouth, my blood pressure goes up. But you have to ask a simple question. He's president, he runs the country, he's basically the prime minister. We've never had a president like this, that every Monday and Thursday he issues statements on the political situation, and no one says boo, and generally speaking, whatever he says is law of the land. And here is Shimon Peres. What are his schliyot? I don't want to say, you know, everybody should love him, all right, he has big schliyot, we haven't had him bombed because of him, we're sitting here because of him, let me not minimize. But as from Jews, look at the Arichat Yomim, look how good he looks, look how chipper, how dashing he is. And the answer is very simple. Look, Charlie, you know the answer? It's very simple. He said that took him as a kid to the Chofetz Chaim to get a bracha. And the Chofetz Chaim gave him a bracha for Arichas Yomim. You follow me, Michael? So Ribbono Shel Olam, imagine what we would give, what an impression it made on the Knessia Gedolah. You read that, by the way, I'm calling from the memoir literature. I wasn't there, but I was there in spirit. And everyone spoke the Chofetz Chaim. Not only that, we have only one picture of the Chofetz Chaim. Interesting. One picture. Chofetz Chaim didn't pose for pictures, didn't believe in pictures. Who was he? He was mighty. He didn't even know who he was. The Anivut, the Chofetz Chaim. So the Rebbe once spoke about it at the Yartzeit Russia. And Mori Rebbe said that at 1923, Rav Meir Shapiro, who was a leading figure, we'll talk about him shortly, represented Polish Jewry, a tremendous Talmud Chacham, the Lublina Rav, the founder of the Lublin Yeshiva, and Rav Meir Shapiro, pleaded with the Chofetz Chaim that we should take your picture. Chofetz Chaim, and this is all in Yiddish, the Rav is telling the story, build, and the Chofetz Chaim says, absolutely not, Vebinich, you know, nothing, and Rav Meir Shapiro says, Rebbe, let me tell you a Devat Torah. Rebbe Meshfi was a gone idea. I heard so much from the Rav. I had such when I opened my mouth in Australia the first time, I told the story that the Rav told me about Rebbe Meir Shapiro. That's the way I began. And I didn't realize I was hitting a Grand Slam home run because the audience in Australia is Mizrahi and Chabad, and they merge together. It's very fascinating. And quoting the Rav, the Mizrahi people were walking on air and telling a Hasidic story, the Chabad people were walking on air. And I don't want to say walking on water. So I hit a Grand Slam home run. So let me tell you a story I heard from the Rav about Rav Meir Shapiro. But this is not the story I told in Australia. It was Yom Yerushalayim, was a different story. But this story is powerful. So Rav Meir Shapiro says to the Chofetz Chaim, let us take your picture. So the Chofetz Chaim says, no, who is it? Let me tell you the Devat Torah. And he quotes the Medrash Rabbah. It's a Dreshit Rabbah, the Mut Yaakov Chakuka al Kisei HaKavod, that the image of Yaakov Avinu is inscribed on the divine throne. And Rav Meir Shapiro asked, Moshe, he rapped out a question. Why Yaakov Avinu? Why not Yitzchak Avinu? Why not Avraham Avinu? You listen to me carefully. A wonderful question. Let's use modern Hebrew. Ma pitom. Those are the first words I learned when I came in Aliyah. Ma pitom and Saflanut. With those words, I already knew modern Hebrew. Ma pitom, Yaakov Avinu. A good question. So he tells the Chofetz Chaim Rebbe, the first Jew to go into Galus was Yaakov Avinu. Avraham came to Eretz Yisrael, and this was his homeland. Yitzchak came. Yitzchak never left Eretz Yisrael. Yaakov Avinu was the first Jew to go into Galus. the Ribbono Shel Olam knew that the Jews are going to suffer, things are going to change, they're going to have to adapt to an alien culture. Ephraim Menashe, I trust you're all familiar with the Malbim. The Rub said it on his own, Rakefet said it on his own, Rothkopf said it on his own, and later I found it's a Malbim. That it's a terrible Shiloh. When they tell Yosef Atzadik, Avicha Choleh, he grabs his two sons and he runs to visit his father. And his father says, Nu mi Ela, who are these kids? Ribbono Shel Olam. Yaakov Avinu did not recognize his own grandchildren? What do you mean, Mi'ela? You lay in Daniel? You're a Balkore? You lay in that? You never asked the question? Mi'ela? So the Malbim explains so beautifully. Yosef was the viceroy. His kids worked in the court of Egypt. They wore Egyptian clothes. Generally, when they went to see their father, they changed their clothes to their Yiddish clothes, a Bekesh, a Regatta, a Shtreimel, a Kippah Struga, call it what you wish, a black hat. This time they came rushing because their father was sick. It was an emergency. You follow me, Michael? There was no time to change. Mi'ela. He didn't know. Who are these kids? He got all frightened. I have a lot of divrei Torah on this, but this is what he said to the Chofetz Chaim. I want to picture the way a Jew still looked before he went into Galus. This is Yaakov Avinu. The Mut Yaakov Chakukal Kisei HaKavod. And he says to the Chofetz Chaim, Rebbe, Torah is going down. Assimilation is great. Chilul Shabbos is all over. The secular Zionists, the socialists, the anarchists, the Bundists, the communists, the Bolsheviks. Let me take a picture of what a Jew looked like, what a Masorah is, what the Demut Yaakov is, min zolzen v'haravat oiskakot. The way the Chofetz Chaim looked, that the Chofetz Chaim agreed, and that's the picture of the Chofetz Chaim. And that took place at this Knesiyah Gedolah. Now, what did they decide here? And these decisions are extremely important. Two of them certainly affect us until today. The first one, of course, and Yoni, here we come to your question, which Yoni asked last week. If you can't have Jewish sovereignty, what are Agudistim doing living here? And it's not, and we'll see afterwards what went on in the 1930s. And you see, they took a dialectical approach. On one hand, it's a mitzvah to live in Israel. It's maybe a mitzvah chiyuvit, a mitzvah chiyumit. Let's leave out the lumdus now. But there's no question that it's a mitzvah to live in Israel. There's no question that this is Admat HaKodesh. There's no question that it's infinitely better to live here and a mitzvah and all that goes with it than any other place in the world. Yishev Eretz Yisrael? Absolutely. Sovereignty? No. You follow the difference? And they were very happy to live under the Arabs. And I have to tell you that when the League of Nations, it's before the UN, but when the League of Nations started sending commissions there, you can check the history, you should know that today you can do a doctorate in Holocaust history, you can do a doctorate in Zionism. There's no end to what can be researched, but there was the Peel Commission, there was the Commission on Arab-Jewish Relations, one commission after another. They came to Israel, that they took testimony in London, and time and again, Agudat Israel, they had Rabbi Blau from the Yishuv HaYashan, and he didn't speak the King's English, so there was Harry Goodman, the president of the Aguda in London, who spoke the King's English. They would testify before these commissions that the Aguda Yisrael is opposed to giving the Jews sovereignty in the land of Israel. So you have this dialectical approach. Yishev Eretz Yisrael, absolutely. They established a Keren HaYishev. They supported the Jews living here. They encouraged to a certain degree, particularly in the 1930s, Goan Aliyah, but they were opposed to sovereignty. I'll only tell you in parentheses about Harry Goodman. He must have been doing something right, because I knew his son. I met grandchildren, great-grandchildren. I don't believe I met one who was not wearing a kippah sruga and who had not served in the IDF. It's like my Vatan Rav Zonnenfeld and Rav Cook. It's an amazing thought that Rav Zonnenfeld has thousands of direct descendants. I'm willing to bet you that the majority, I know many of them, I taught some of them, the majority totally integrated into the Kippah Sruga world, religious Zionist world, most of them did Hezda. Chief Rabbi Metzko, who's married to a great-granddaughter, was a paratrooper. He was in Kerem Biavna, did Hezda, etc., etc. And Rav Kook has so few descendants who survived. Some were killed by the Arabs, lo aleinu, but the majority of his descendants are in Degel HaTorah today. It's fascinating if you make the cheshbon and you look who is who. So Harry Goodman, who used to testify, Baruch Hashem, 80 years later, many of his direct descendants, if not all, are very happy under Jewish sovereignty in the state of Israel. But that was their point of view, a dialectical point of view. Karen and Yishuv, yes, sovereignty, no. Yes, Michael.
These are intelligent people. They right. understood the politics and the history of the time. Given the fact that after World War I, all these national ethnic states were being created in Europe, colonialism was collapsing, who did they think was going to be the sovereign government of this country?
They were very happy to live under the English.
But that wasn't going to happen.
There was the English rule there.
You're
looking at it post-1948, but the English fought bitterly, 20, 30s, into the 40s. It could be, had Menachem Begin not blown up the King David Hotel, the English would still be sitting here. So, you know, you're looking with the hindsight of history.
I'm not. Given the desire for our sovereignty.
But let's put it this way.
British and French weren't going to stick around the Middle East.
Right. Let's put it this way. In the 1920s, the Agudat Yisrael position was a minority position. The overwhelming percentage of Jews didn't agree with them. The Mizrahi, which was a very powerful organization, didn't agree with them, but this was their position. As we said last week, and I don't want to be a wise guy, but it's absolutely true. And I told you, remember what I said last week in the name of the Rav? That's very unbelievable. The Rav, I repeat it because it's so important. The Rav in a Yahrzeit Russia, the Rav had a terrific sense of humor. So in a Yahrzeit Russia, I guess he wanted to wake the audience up. So he told us, whenever you argue with Chassidim, there are two questions you can ask them that they have no answer for. And the Rav started laughing. He said, one question is Tvila Shalo Bizman. I mean, it's an open Mishnayot and Bracha. How you daven? Chabad begins Shabbos morning, 9:30. I can tell you in my shul that is a Chabad minyan on the side. And the day begin in the shtibble at 9:30. Who ever heard of davening so late? And the other question is, of course, how do you, in Chutz Laretz, not sit in the sicker and shmini atzeres? All right, Rakevin has given many shurim on this topic. I could make a living out of it, believe me. But it goes against an open Gemara, daf mem zayin amen aleph, masechet sukkah, yeteg yatvinen, bareich lo mevarchinen. Am I right, Moshe? What did you do in Chutz Laretz? What did you do? You sat in the sukkah, you didn't sit in the sicker shmini atzeres. Of course, I ate everything in a sukkah. I didn't make a bracha leishem a sukkah, but all right. That's the chutz laretz. And Eretz Yisrael, of course, so there's a cheirim kadmon, and the crazy tourists that come today and want to sit in a sukkah, I tell them you'll be in cheirim. At the black cat, they think it's a mitzvah to observe a full 2 days here. So then they call, I tell them, you call a Rebbe who's over 50, someone who knows. You know, but it'll disappear within 20 years. Everyone from America who observes 2 days will be eating in a circle, be in cheirim, zol zayin gezunt. That's the way life is sometimes.
Do you think that there was even a consideration that they could possibly wind up under Arab sovereignty?
Yeah, sure. They didn't mind.
That was acceptable.
Yeah. So let me go one step further. It's what I said last week. So I said, if you, the Eide Haredit never lets the Aguda forget that there's Jewish sovereignty. Do you read Hachomah of the Eid al-Haray did. Time and again they punched them. How could you have changed? How could you have changed your position? How could you go against the Gedolei Yisrael of Chaim Meiser and the Gerer Rebbe and the Baruch Bel Leibovich and all these Gedolei? And we'll come back to it again. And when you hit them with this, they have nowhere to turn. More than that, I want to go one step beyond the Eid al-Haray did. This is a contradiction ab initio. If you believe in Das Torah and it's infallible, how could the greatest Rabbanim have been so wrong? You follow? No Agudas can answer this. They turn away, they double talk you, they punch you in the mouth and walk away in anger, they call you an apikoros, but a good answer they can't give. Some of them who have honest minds are chozer b'tshuva and become the greatest citizens of the state of Israel. Baruch Hashem. I need not go further. We have many examples of good Hasidic Shehidim who have done so much for this country, including one Gerer Chassid. You don't even realize it, that we're sitting here because of a Gerer Chassid in Bnei Brak. No, who knows what I'm talking about? Who has lived here for 43 years? What do you think? I'm making it up? We don't know his name. They never allow the publication of his name, but 10 years ago or 15 years ago, Mariv and Yediot did 10-page investigative reporting that got the censor cleared. But it's a small country, we all know the story. 1973, 20% of the Israeli Air Force was wiped off the map. Are you aware of that? You know what that means to lose 20% of your pilots? You know how much it costs to train a pilot? You have any idea what's involved with planes and pilots and what goes on with the support system? It's unbelievable. I've seen it. I've had tours of Telnov, etc. In the army, a reward for lectures I give. 20%. The missiles knocked us out of the sky like blowing out candles on a birthday cake. The Egyptian missiles. A chassid in Bnei Brak, a Gerer chassid, who never graduated elementary school. A genius. He figured out how to come up with an anti-missile device. He's the one, what every Israeli plane has today, that the minute a missile comes towards the plane, I'm not a physicist, so don't take me at face value, but general understanding, it gives off heat that deflects the missile, because the missile is programmed to go after the heat. It hits this phony heat plane-like, which is way on the side of the plane. It does no damage to the plane whatsoever. This was used successfully in 82 in Lebanon, where we shot down 86 Syrian planes, and the only plane we lost was on Shabbos, a malfunction. And Lo Aleinu, on that plane was a Hezda boy, the Katz. It was Rabbi Hartman's, David Hartman's son-in-law. And he was the navigator, was a Skyhawk. He was the navigator on that plane to where people were. And it had nothing to do with the missiles. The missiles went all over, never hit us. Some of you know that they're now, I don't know military secrets, it may now be in every LL plane you have this system. And it all goes back to this Hassan Bnei Brak, when the army met with him, the top people in weapons development, that's a different part of the army. My son-in-law was in it for 20 years. He was in the tank. He has awards for night sight on Merkava 2, Merkava 3. That was his specialty. He's a graduate of Machon Lev, electro-optics. And whenever the chassid was meeting with them and explaining to them and diagramming, no women were allowed in the room in accordance with Gera practice. It's fascinating. I mean, I don't agree with that. I've seen Gera, I'm frightened stiff. I saw with my own eyes a Gera chassid. I spoke at his engagement, and he comes into the room, and there are women there. This is a kid of 21, 22, and he starts shaking. And people explain to me he was shaking because he's never been in a room before where there are also women. Okay, I'm not here to advocate Gerer Chassidut, but I have to respect them, and I have to respect the Gerer Chassid that put the IDF on the map after the Yom Kippur War. You're a Gera Chassid who negated, nullified, abrogated the Aguda thinking was never done officially. Well, we'll see what happened. But that's the answer. You can't, they were thinking a certain way, they had a certain gestalt, and that's the way they thought. Okay? Another decision made that affects all of us until today is Reb Meir Shapiro, the Daf Yomi. Now, much has been written who was really the idea behind the Daf Yomi. I just read the other day, I'm reading a book on Rishon HaChassidus. So it turns out that Reb Meir, they called Reb Meir Shapiro, that the Chishtan and the Rebbe had told him, Reb Meir, I don't know who gave him the idea, but Reb Meir Shapiro deserves the credit because he's the one that got up at the Aguda convention. He was an amazing speaker, and he got up and put the Daf Yomi on the map. The idea behind it, he told the story, again, it's anecdotal, that he was traveling on a train. And his mother began to cry. And you know, you understand, there's the Yuridat HaDorot. There's, I see in my own lifetime, I see in the Kolel, you don't start to understand the difference between your generation and 20 years ago in the Kolel. I see it in my classroom. A student just came over to me a half hour ago and told me he can't come to class anymore. Your day is too hard. He has to concentrate. And 25 years ago, everyone came to every class, but they had one advantage on you. Your Adeo wasn't so hard, the Gemara wasn't so hard. They grew up without art scroll. At the age of 12, 13, they had to learn how to master texts. Today, you're living in a different world. I walk up and down the Beis Midrash, I see you have so many books of this in English, that in English, the third thing in English. It's Yuridat HaDorot, plain and simple, and I see it in my own lifetime. I have to come and say to me, Rishonim Kamalachim, Anu B'nei Tamuta, Rishonim B'nei Tamuta, Anu Chamorim, V'afilu Lo K'chamor Pinchas Ben Yair. And I can see, and I feel bad. I feel bad. You know, if I thought I was teaching courses that you can get afterwards, alright, what's the difference? But I see the Yuridat HaDorot, V'fayne Shema. Okay, this Daf Yomi, his mother started to cry. You're traveling. You're not going to learn. You're not going to keep up. What are you going to do? And he came up with the idea of the Daf Yomi, and that way all the Jews will be learning the same thing. And when you travel, you leave Vilna, and the Rebbe said a shir in Chulin on Daf Daf, And 2 days later you're in Warsaw and you're continuing in Chulin, the Rebbe saying Yeshir, and everyone is learning the same Daf. And Daf Yomi began in 1923. It was one of the results of the Knesiyah Gedolah. I need not tell you how it caught on, I need not tell you how big it has become. Now, it has an upside and a downside. The upside is obviously I've never seen so many Jews learning so much Torah. It is really, I would say, it inspires you. I have a grandson, one of my younger grandsons. He's, if I'm not mistaken, he's all of 14 now. He'll be 15 Hanukkah time. And he learns Daf Yomi already. In Chorev, there's a whole Chabura learning. And he knows that I speak with the art. He has a good head. I have to say. It's a grandson. Wow. A sharp head. His shop. He's learning Daf Yomi. Everyone's learning Daf. Beautiful, beautiful to see. The downside, and I've seen people attack them in public, and I don't know why you attack. The downside is obvious. Some people learn a Daf Yomi like I say Ashrei. No, Ashrei, Yoshrei, don't give up, don't give up, halavai, they asked Rav Shach, why were you Zaycha to Aricha Jami? No, what did Rav Shach answer? He answered, because I always bench holding a bencher in front of me. People walked away laughing. I understood Rav Shach. We benched. The benching. Wow. Pay attention. So, of course, I've seen students, when out in the world, busy, creating, doing, and they learned Daf Yomi. I've seen the way they learned Daf Yomi. All right. It's a downside. It's not really deep learning. But on the other hand, they wouldn't be learning at all. And many people, I have to tell you, so many Baal Tshuva, when Rakepet would get up like an idiot and criticize Art Scroll because what it's done, that it's made, that no one speaks Hebrew today, no one knows Lashon HaKodesh, guys in the Gris Kolel can't come to classes because they're overwhelmed by the Gemara, they're overwhelmed by Yoredeya, they're overwhelmed by Eben Ezra. So whenever I say a critical word in public, and I don't say it anymore, I wised up because I got my face smacked too many times, Baal Tshuva came over to me and said, Rebbe, we're only from because of the Shachmas thing. Made us from. These are, you know, intelligent people, professors of math, professors of biology, world-class lawyers, and they opened up a Gemara. Hey, there's something to Yiddishkeit. There's something behind it. No, the minute I hear that, believe me, I have to say, Shabbos Din is the greatest gift that our generation has. We can be very proud that a Yeshiva College graduate underwrites it, Jay Shabbos Din, and very, very simple. I'm very proud. He's as a private rabbi, as my student, how he's act, do the shul for him, etc. Beautiful. But if it makes people Shomer Shabbos, I'm a terrible guy, but I'd rather have 1 million Shomer Shabbos, even though we might not have 1 million lamdanim as a result. Okay. But Dafyomi caught on. And out of the Dafyomi came already Mishnayot Yomit, Perek Tanakh Yomi, the Rambam, the Yerushalmi. And if you want to be cynical, you can judge a Jew by what he learns every day. If he learns Dafyomi, there's a simon as a Litvak, and a Buddhist, a Shtikla Mizrachis Deichet. If he learns Yerushalmi, he is a Gera Chassid. That's what the Gera said, the Gera Rebbeim. All right, they're learning Bavli, we have to learn Yerushalmi. Rambam, no? Anyone here Chabatnik? How can it be I'm teaching a class and there's not one Chabatnik here? This is not good, it's not healthy. I need someone to relate to the little Chabat in my soul, okay? There is a little Chabat, believe me. No? If you learn the Rambam, a parak in the Rambam each day, you're a Chabadnik. But all these ideas came out of the Daf Yomi. Now, another, so that affects us until today. Yeah, I mean, remember, I love Torah. I may be the greatest religious Zionist in this room. I think the Washington book says it, but I love Torah. Have to have an appreciation. If I go to Israel too, where I differ, but where I appreciate, I appreciate. Now, they did something else that affects us until today. Until Labriyut, until the 20th century, women knew their place in life. What was their place in life? To be on a Keret Habayit. They were proud. If you look into the YU, to the YU list of graduates, the book of all their graduates. So I just this morning happened to see Sarah Lamb married to Mark Drach, my student. And I see Sarah Wright, she is a housewife and she is proud. Beautiful. My wife is a housewife. The day she found out she was pregnant with our eldest child, that was the day she stopped working outside of the house. Baruch Hashem. No, women knew who they were, what they were, where they came from. Whereas I once said in my lectures on feminism, the year devoted to feminism, it was a wonderful world. The father tied his daughter in a ribbon and presented her to her husband. There was never a problem. By the way, I'm paraphrasing the Chafetz Chaim in Likutei Halacha on Saita. I don't have to tell you with modern times, education and Fiddler on the Roof, which is a reflection of life, that's exactly what was happening. Every Jewish girl who went to gymnasium, 99% threw religion away. And along came Sarah Schneer, the seamstress, divorcee, had an unhappy life, whatever. And she came up with the idea to educate women. The Belzer Rebbe gave her a bracha. But nevertheless, Beit Yaakov was very limited in scope. In 1923, Agudat Yisrael officially adopted Beit Yaakov as their educational arm. Wherever there would be branches of Agudah, there would be Beis Yaakov schools. And due to the fact that Agudat Yisrael adopted it, and that went way beyond Bells, because Bells did not join Agudat Yisrael. Bells was much closer to Munkach, or what you know as Satmar, than to Agudat Yisrael until the 1970s. Bells was totally opposed to any Aguder and anything new and any change in life and Chadash Asum in HaTorah and all that goes with it. But when Agudat Yisrael adopted Beis Yaakov, it became a force. Wherever there was an Aguder branch, there was a Beis Yaakov. And again, this is revolutionary. Nathaniel Fishman is not going to go fishing for a Beis Yaakov girl, Bisman has said. Could be. She's not learned enough for him. She's not open enough for him. She's not broad enough for him. Nathaniel, you married?
Not married.
Oh, good. So I can pick on you. Good. Great. I'm happy. I hit the nail on the head. I don't want to pick on Daniel, or I can cause problems when he comes home. But Daniel, take it with a grain of salt and a smile. Nathaniel, you understand? Today, you Beis Yaakov, you have Nishmat, you have Matan, you have Stern College, you have Michlala, you have Orot. Today, Orot just opened the branch, I think, with women who sing, women who dance. There's now in Yerushalayim, I have a granddaughter-in-law graduating in Muna in art. It's amazing. A girl can do everything today. But Beis Yaakov today, so you look, it's narrow. Well, all right, it's true. Beis Yaakov is narrow. It depends certainly on the Beis Yaakov. A Beis Yaakov in Baltimore, it's going to be a lot more open than a Beis Yaakov in Bnei Brak. Goes without saying. But this, for the 1920s, this was revolutionary. Women learned Chumash. Women learned Rashi. Women learned Musa. Women learned Kitzur Shulchan Aruch. Women learn Jewish history. All right, I'm not saying it was the Jewish history that we teach and scholarly, but they learned Jewish history. And this was epic making. And we owe that to Agudat Yisrael. And Beis Yaakov until today, in the Israeli system where you have Chinuch Atzmai, the girls' division is called Beis Yaakov. It's a direct descendant of the decision in 1923. Okay. They did something else too. This world is rapidly disappearing. It's interesting. Who could ever believe it would disappear? A newspaper. You don't realize how revolutionary a newspaper is. The Lubavitcher Rebbe, I have this on tape, at a Fabrengen in 1972, it was taped off the radio. I was living in Israel, but Rabbi Manny Holes had taped it off the radio. The Baba Chiretti was on the radio then. It's before TV, but and he taped it for me. He was a fabulous Fabrengen. And the Rebbe, everyone was criticizing the Rebbe. He introduced at that time, Kol Ein Vabat Madlikan Neirot Shabbat. He introduced that women are looking, it's the feminist revolution by the 1970s. Bella Abzug and Gloria Steinem, what went on in that period. And the girls were looking for something. So it's fascinating, the Rebbe had, I don't know if it was twice a year, could very well be, he had Fabrengens for women only. Are you aware of that? That all of 70 was filled with thousands of women. And the only men in the room were the Rebbe and his Gabbai. And it was a regular Hitva'adut Chassidut dealing with women topics. I mean, you got to give the Rebbe all the credit. And then he took a mitzvah that women have, Hadlakat Neirot. And tell me, who lights candles here when you're in the dormitory? What do you do, Nathaniel? You're not married. What do you do for candles?
Our apartment, we have a nightlight. We use that.
You're not listening. What, you light two candles?
Not candles. No.
Nightlight. With Aleph Lamedes, nightlight, keep it vioning. I don't want to criticize. But candles, you see you're not lighting. Why aren't you lighting? You don't want to be called a woman, a sissy. It's a woman's mitzvah. Tefillin you put on, candles you don't light. I don't know. Is there a head to not light candles? Do you understand? Being serious. It's a chiyuv on candles. He doesn't. His mother's not here. He's not married. All right. It'd be a better etza If you went to Danny Wolf and gave him 10 agarot to have a share in the candles, and tell him when he lights to have you, when his wife lights to have in mind all the sinners who are not yet married. Got it? The Gemara at the end of Kedusha. I'm quoting the Gemara. Believe me, I suffer. I have one grand of, you know, grandsons, one of them, they're a little older, not married yet. That's a health mission. Back here. Gentlemen, the Rebbe came out, let the single girls light candles, and there is precedent for it. There is precedent, and became very strong in Chabad. Kolein v'bat matlikan neirot Shabbat. And the Rebbe was attacked. And one of the reasons he was attacked, the Aruch HaShulchan actually agrees with the Rebbe. He was attacked, it's an innovation. So the Rebbe in the Fabrayin says, what are they attacking me? I'm innovating. He says every Torah Jew in the world today has innovated. He says 100 years ago, where did Jews get the news? Zem gizitzin hof, from shul hof, tzivishin minchan mariv. They would sit in the courtyard of the shul between mincha mariv, and one Jew knew what was going on in the world. He heard that this happened in Austria, and this happened in America, and this happened in England. It happened months earlier, but the news reached him, and he would tell them the news. That's the way the Jews got the news 100 years ago. He says, who doesn't read a newspaper today? And I never yet heard that people should criticize Torah Jews for reading newspapers. Chadash Asumin HaTorah. And you don't realize what an innovation this was. And Agudat Yisrael came up with the idea that we have to have daily religious newspapers. And I can tell you, the Das Yiddische Tageblatt came out in Warsaw. Der Heimt, which means today, appeared in Riga. Wherever there was a large amount of Jews, particularly Hasidic Jews, they had religious newspapers. This caught on. Now, today in the Haredi world, do you know how many newspapers you have? Every other one. I came in Aliyah, every party in Israel had its own newspaper. Davar was Chanezema, the Marach, the Mapai. Al HaMishmar was Mapam. Everyone had their own newspaper. One by one, every newspaper disappeared. Mizrahi, Hatzofer. Today, you come into Meir Sharim, you come into Geula, Hamudia. What's the Gala Torah's newspaper called? Hamudia is the Hasidish one. The Gala Torah has its own newspaper. Reporish has his own newspaper, Hamavaser, Shas has its own newspaper, Miyom Liyom, Yabiu, it's a play on Rabbi Avadya Sfarim. Even the religious Zionist world finally resuscitated a newspaper, but it's on a very high level already. It represents modernity and the fact that religious people are in every field today, and that, of course, is Makar Rishon. So it's interesting that the secular party-oriented newspapers ultimately couldn't go further. And the religious people, where perhaps it has to do, they don't have television, they don't listen to radio, but wow, you should see on Friday, if you've ever been in Geula, when they put Hashavua out in the street, the freebie that's distributed Friday, thousands of people are jumping on HaShavuah, thousands upon thousands of copies. And this all goes back to 1923, the Knesiyah Gedolah. 1929, once again, Agudah has grown, Agudah has caught on. Once again in Vienna, the Knesiyah Gedolah. An awe-inspiring sight. The enemies call it the Strangel Convention.
How long were these meetings?
It was like a week, like from Monday through Thursday.
And they could go and stay for the whole week?
Well, I would imagine not all the Gedolim stayed for the whole week. People came, people showed. Generally, there was an overflow for Shabbos. These were very serious. This is like a regular convention with all that goes with it. But to answer your question, what happened at the second Knesiyah Gedolah is very fascinating. And it reveals who we are, what we are, who has strength, who has different strength. Have you ever heard of honorary smicha? Have you ever heard of that title? Honorary smicha. What do you say, Moshe? Honorary smicha, what is this, an honorary doctorate? Either you know or you don't know. What are you going to give, an idiot smicha? An amoret smicha? So let me tell you a little story of the Yeshiva University. It's no good to know too much, but I'll tell the story without any names. He's no longer alive. I taught his children afterwards. This man, his father was one of the biggest supporters of JTS. And the son became totally frum. And big business. And he got a bug in his head that he wanted to get smicha from the yeshiva. So he came to the yeshiva. They took someone who today is a very famous Rebbe and hired him. You know, no big deal for him to hire a private Rebbe, prepare him, learn with him. And in those days, the smicha exams were oral. I need not tell you that if people would collect the anecdotes from those still alive who took the oral exam, they would tell you how they have ulcers until today as a result. Can you picture coming into a room? There's the Rav sitting there, Rav Moshe Shatzkis, and thank God, Rav Shmuel Belkin. Kids would come in, the Rav would go after him, and what would go on? So this poor guy comes in, and the Rav starts asking him, and the Rav says to Dr. Belkin afterwards, I can't garnish, he knows nothing. Yeah, the Rav, and Rabbi Belkin says to the Rav, he says, Beryl, I never asked you for a favor, but I must give this young man smicha. View it as an honorary smicha, but it means a lot of support for the yeshiva. And the guy Taka got smicha, and he became a member of the board of trustees, and over the years he gave the yeshiva, in terms of money in that period, hundreds of thousands of dollars. Fabulous individual. But I always knew that that was an honorary smicha. When I did research on the Gurdjieff Yisrael, I found out that long before Dr. Belkin insisted on giving this individual an honorary smicha, HaKadosh Yisrael in 1929, Moreinu HaRav Reb Yaakov Rosenheim, who was he? He was from Frankfurt. He grew up on the lap of Reb Shimshon Rafal Hirsch. He was a Yekka through and through. Blue-blooded Yekka, from committed, but all the good traits of Yekkiism. No Hasidus, no Litvish learning, but organized, pedantic. Knew how to run an office, knew how to administer an organization. And believe it or not, the central office of Agudat Yisrael was moved to Germany. And Reb Yaakov Rosenheim out of Germany ran a malucha. He put together the first Knesiyah and did even a greater job at the second Knesiyah. And Agudat Yisrael didn't know what to do for him. And at that Knesiyah, they gave him an honorary smicha, signed by the Chafetz Chaim and Reb Chaim Moshe Brzezinski on the first line. I've seen pictures of it. I believe the Gera Rebbe was on the first line, and underneath many other signatures. And it declared that Reb Yaakov Rosenheim was officially to be called and known, and whenever his name was published, whenever his name was published, Moreinu HaRav, Reb Yaakov Rosenheim. And he lived to a good age. He was born in 1870. He died in 1966 in B'nai Brak. Had an interesting life. From Germany, he ran away to England to avoid Hitler. From England, he came to America. From America, he went in Aliyah and spent his final years in B'nai Brak. And everyone who knew him formally referred to him, Morenu Harav, Reb Yaakov Rosenheim. Now, there was one other development, and I put it just real during this period, that paralleled the development in Mizrahi. Remember I told you, I believe it was 1922, Hapoel Mizrahi broke away from Mizrahi and they were to remain separate until they reunited in 1956. In 1923, Pole Agudat Yisrael broke away from Agudat Yisrael. They had different needs, different interests. You now had settlements. You now had what later would become Chafetz Chaim. There's a whole area around Chafetz Chaim that you have Moshavim and Shalavim and all in the spirit of Poli Agudat Yisrael. It's not that they broke with Aguda, but their interest for the laborer, for the worker, they were no longer capitalists, they were no longer bourgeoisie. They had to take care of their own, they had to deal with problems of Shemitah, they had to deal with problems of Mitzvot HaTliyot Ba'aretz. It's a different aura. What's fascinating is that our poem Mizrahi comes back to Mizrahi. Ultimately, Poli Agudat Yisrael breaks with Agudat Yisrael and ultimately disappears. And making a long history very short, why did it break with Agudat Yisrael? Because they became part and parcel of the Israeli scene. They were integrated with the Israeli scene. And at one point, Poli Agudat Yisrael joined the government. What Aguda does today, they did 30, 35 years ago, 40 years ago, it was 50 years ago, I should say. It was revolutionary. It was the early 60s when they heard of Aguda joining the government at that point, and they put them in Cherem. And then what happened was their children, their grandchildren, there was no longer a need for Poli Aguda, because there's an unbelievable development here. The black world became very strong, and the Mizrahi world developed what we call popularly Chardalim, Charedim, Datiim, Lu'umiyim. Mizrahi became very firm. Generally speaking, 50, 60 years ago, the average Mizrahi woman did not cover her hair. She thought she was in Lithuania yet. Today, go to Yehuda V'Shomer, go to Merkaz Arav, go to Yeshiva Hesda, 99% of the women married cover their hair. It's a different world today. The Frumkeit in Yehuda B'Shomron is probably more. I once heard a big Aguda leader say, but an honest individual stated in public that our women are not as sneistic as the women in Yehuda B'Shomron. Our women wear shaitels and put on makeup and wear the latest fashions. And he says, I go to Yehuda B'Shomron and I go to the settlements. The women are in tichels without makeup and they're not dressed with the latest fashions. The tzniut is greater. And I heard this in public from Dudi Zibushlai with my own ears. So you see what happened ultimately with the children and grandchildren of the Poli Aguda world. Either they went Panovich, Chassidish, black, totally, using popular language, or they moved into the Mizrahi world, and a great deal moved into the Mizrahi world, the backbone of Ezra and the Chadalim, and Poli Aguda, Shalavim is the result of Poli Aguda, but Poli Aguda no longer exists. It once was a force. Today, it has no electorate. It voted itself off the map because the split, the chasm, gave them choice. Why be small? You want to be Panovich? Be Panovich. You want to be Shalavim? Be Shalavim. So that is a fascinating development. And now we come to the heart of today's lecture. 1937, Marion Bart. Gam ki yelech v'gen samavet lo yirara ki atai imadil. And what becomes very important to this lecture, I cite to you the basic research that appeared in the Silver Era in American Jewish Orthodoxy. My wife found this on my work table at home, and she said, what did you Xerox from your book for? I said, am I allowed to quote it in class? I quote so many Svarim, so for once, let me quote my own scholarship. Reb Lezer Silva, and I said this in my Hesped in the House of Mourning for Rabbi Benny Eisner, Zecher Tzadik Livracha. It tied in with what had happened. I can't go into detail now, but right before me, Rabbi Yaakov Shapiro of Merkaz spoke about Benny Eisner, and he mentioned Rav David Chai Cohen. He spoke about something with Rav David Chai Cohen. Rav David Chai Cohen was the first wedding I participated in Israel in 1969. He married Reb Lezer Silva's granddaughter. He's the Rav of Bat Yam today, I believe it is. Rav David Chai Cohen, remember the name. And I was able to make that connection and work in Rav David Chai Cohen, Reb Lezer Silva, and whatever I had to say about our departed colleague, Rabbi Benny Eisner. So Reb Lezer was the last American rabbi to achieve fame as a rabbi. Today in America, people over the world barely know the names of rabbis. If they know the names of rabbis, it's only because they want a shnur and they go to see Rabbi Lookstein or to see some other prominent rabbi and ask for money. No one turns to well-known practicing rabbis, the Paskin Shilas, to write responsible literature. Today, the Rosh Yeshiva are the ones that rule. And this has been a gradual development, but nevertheless, it is a fact. Reb Lezer Silva was the last American rabbi you can speak of who became a world figure. Everyone knew Reb Lezer Silva, a Gaon, a tremendous Talmud Chacham, an activist. Reb Lezer was Reb Lezer. He was one of a kind. As you know from, if you've heard my lectures on the Rav, and I've said this and I can prove it 1,000 times over, the Rav in the 1930s had one image that he looked up to in America. He had one person he wanted to model himself on, Reb Lezer Silva. And if you want to know how much the Rav thought of Reb Lezer Silva, at the Lichtenstein wedding, where the Rav was there, and Reb Aaron Soloveitchik is there, and Reb Moshe Feinstein is there, and Reb Shmuel Belkin is there, and Reb David Lifshitz is there, and Lochas Chassidim, Chassidic Rebbeim, Mitzad, the Chatan, Tversky, Zeichet Tzadik Livracha, Yitzchak Tversky, the Rav is Mechabed, Reb Lezer Silva, L'Sadeh Kedushin. You follow me? That tells you something. You with me, Moshe? Reb Lezer Silva was Mesadeh Kedushin. That tells you something. So, Reb Lezer, now in 37, is at the height of his prestige, power, fame, the Rav of Cincinnati since 1932, the president of the Agudat HaRabbanim, and by the way, the name of the Degel HaTorah paper is Yateid Ne'eman. Remember before I said Modi and I couldn't do it. Degel HaTorah's paper is Yateid Ne'eman, Yateid, the peg that is honest. Don't get me started, but let that be. Okay. Michael, let it be. I don't want to get sick. So Reb Lezer decides he's going to Europe. Goes to Europe. And there was a lot of opposition. You should know the Agudat HaRabbanim, Rabbi Leventhal, Rabbi Kanvich, were told him, you have no right to go. You don't represent the Agudat HaRabbanim. We're Mizrachiites. And Reb Lezer said, I am going as a private individual. I want to see Europe. I want to see where I grew up. I want to see my Rebbeim. Rabbi Blazer comes and he's all excited, and I have to tell you that I so can appreciate this. It's like, lahavdil, like, who am I to put myself and compare myself? But I know the feeling of joy I had when I got to Boston in 1978 to spend a Shabbat with my Rebbe. So Rabbi Blazer describes how he arrives in Vilna and he goes looking for Rabbi Chaim Isaac Rozhinsky, and I quote to you from the Suv Era, page 158, I arrived in Vilna, and even the Gentiles knew where Rabbi Grzynski was. They directed me to his summer residence, which was outside the city proper. The Gaon received me with great joy. He declared his delight in being reunited with his student and claimed that actually improved his physical health. And I can tell you I understand that, because a Rebbe, on in years, when he meets a student of 40, 50 years earlier, the Rebbe feels younger. I understand that. I accompanied on his walks, and it's like I walked the Rav home from shul. He inquired about all the Rabbanim and scholars in America. He explained the inner workings of Aguda, told me what the Council of Torah Sages, Gedolei HaTorah, Nisiya Gedolah. My greatest joy was on the Sabbath when I spent the entire day with him. Late into Saturday night, I sat at his table enthralled by his knowledge, insight, and joyful spirit. Rav Leizer later describes how he and Rav Elchanan Wasserman go in to visit the Gerer Rebbe on Shabbos. And the Gerer Rebbe is totally engrossed in Torah study. As was his practice, Rabbi Alter, this is Rabbi Avraham Mordechai Alter, this is the third Gerer Rebbe, this is the son of the Sfat Emet. Rabbi Alter did not engage in secular talk on the Sabbath, but rather only discussed Torah and Talmudic topics. For the next hour, Silva enjoyed every moment as he posed question after question concerning difficult Talmudic passages to the Rebbe. Most were resolved on the spot by Rabbi Alter, who is both a celebrated scholar and the charismatic leader of tens of thousands of Hasidim. Then he describes his meeting with Rabbi Menachem Zemba. Rabbi Menachem Zemba was a Polish yakon. You have no idea. He had an intellectual approach that resembled bris to learning. He had unbelievable manuscripts. He had a hardware store. He refused to be a rav until the dark days of the 30s, where he had to give up the store and became a rav in Warsaw, was locked up as the Gaon of Warsaw. All his manuscripts perished in the Holocaust. What we lost. So these were the people, these were the Gedolei Yisrael, these were the people he met. Now, Rav Chaim Moshe said to him, Leizer, Ichaldas Ishen Zaitas Mendav Grinden an Agudas Yisrael in America. He said, my student Leizer, I hold it as time to organize Agudat Yisrael in America. Now we have to understand, they tried to organize Agudat Yisrael in America in the 1920s and the 1930s. It didn't get off the floor. 99% of American Jewry were Zionist. If you were religious, you were a Mizrachiite. This was the height of the Zionist dream. This was the height of going back, building the land. Agudat Yisrael? Who's interested? But by the late 30s, by 37, you had a new type of immigrant to the United States. Before you came to America, because America was the golden land, if you made a decision to come to America, you knew that there was a very good chance that your children would become Mechallelei Shabbos. And nevertheless, they came. And you all know Rabbi Dr. Professor Chaim Soloveitchik, my classmate, Dr. Grach, as you call him, his classic article, Rupture and Reconstruction. And even though there was criticism, Read Torah Modern Journal, where Chaim's attacked, and yes, there were always families in America that remained from, but they were an absolute minority. And I'd be amazed if someone could show one family that came to America after 1870, where 80% of the children, the direct descendants, are still Jews and from. I'd be amazed. And I know my wife's family came to America in the 1870s. She has great grandparents buried in Queens. And a good deal of the family remained from. But a part of the family totally assimilated. I know my family. And I can tell you, while at Mata Kodesh, from my wife's family and my family, we have hundreds of direct descendants today. Everyone Shomer Torah mitzvah, essentially. But what happened in America, those that were not part of this, God have mercy. But by 1937, people were coming to America, not because they wanted to, coming to save their lives. Hitler, Germany. Look at the way the president of Iran just spoke yesterday. No, when you hear such talk, all right, the president of Iran, I'm not going to lose sleep over. But Hitler, Germany, Chutzlaritz, power. And these Jews, many of them had a commitment. If you've heard the name George Kranzler, Gershon Kranzler, mean anything to you? Zecher Tzadik Livracha. Gershon Kranzler was a Torah Vadas boy who later gets a PhD from the New School of Social Research at Columbia University. He writes a doctorate on Williamsburg. He was principal in Beis Yaakov in Baltimore for many decades. TA in Baltimore. I think also, not the Beis Yaakov, no? TA, okay, I stand corrected, thank you. There's a large Kranzler family. He's part of that family. You've heard the name YU. That's his nephew. Who runs admissions in YU. I taught his daughter in Michalah before the younger students here were born. Take my word for it. So in his doctorate, it's a sociological doctorate, so he has interviews with people. So you see people who came in the late 30s. One of them says so beautifully, I came to America knowing what happened to everyone who came before me, but I came resolved that I would raise my son no different than the way I was raised in Poland. And when I see my son today with Payas and Agato, I'm very satisfied that Baruch Hashem, we succeeded. So that now you have people, candidates for Agudat Yisrael. Now you can organize, and Agudat Yisrael, it's like fertile ground. It's not like 1932 or 1922. This is 1937. Reb Lazer comes back. He begins in 38. By 39, in Far Rockaway, not far from when Daniel comes from, the first convention of Agudat Yisrael is held. And you have Reb Lazer Silva, Reb Shlomo Hyman, the Torah Vedas Rosh Yeshiva, Talmud Mufak of Reb Baruch Be'er Leibovich, the Biyana Rebbe, Reb Mordechai Shlomo Friedman, who was the biggest Rebbe in America at that time. You have people, leadership, response. 1940, Reb Chaim Eisen dies early August. The middle of August is the Agudah Convention. And Reb Lazer decides to hold it out of New York, not just out of New York, in Cincinnati, his hometown. Not just in Cincinnati, his hometown, but in Cincinnati, the bastion of Reform Judaism, Hebrew Union College. There was nothing else yet. Today, you have Hebrew Union College, you have Jewish Institute of Rabbi, the New York branch, you have a Los Angeles branch. Then Cincinnati was the capital of Reform Judaism. And Reb Lazer Silva brings this rebbeim from New York, Rashi Yeshiva. The Cincinnati press goes crazy. Strimals on the streets of Cincinnati. The Reformed Jews are livid with rage.
But Agudat Yisrael is on the map. What happens at that convention is a source of lectures, discussion. I've heard 1,001 different theories. I stand on what I've been saying for the last 50 years on this topic. Chaim Moser died. The highlight of the convention is Sunday, when Mori Rebbe, Rebbe Yosef Dovah, maybe Soloveitchik, the rabbi of Boston, not yet having found himself, not yet in YU, gives the eulogy for Reb Chaim Iser Grushinsky. Gentlemen, how many of you have seen that eulogy? If you haven't seen that eulogy, you don't know how to breathe air. If you agree with the totality of the eulogy, you have a real problem, because the Rav later changed his mind. But I've heard this from a good distant. It was the most agudist, das Torah presentation ever given on the soil of the United States. Do you remember that eulogy? Hatzitzvah HaChoshen, where the Rav described, yet the people who were there, they said the Rav was in his prime, at the height, a young man, soaring, sailing. He knew Rav Chaim Iser Grushinsky very well. He knew him, part of the Brisker greater family. Rav Chaim Iser was married to his wife's cousin. Both the Rav and Rav Chaim Iser married great-great-granddaughters of Rav Yisrael Salanter. He knew Rav Chaim Iser from Vilna. That's where his wife came from. That's where he spent half a year before his marriage, or many months before his marriage. Spoke and learning with Rav Chaim Iser many times. And he spoke in terms, what does the Choshen Mishpat represent? Klal Yisrael, the Shvatim, political questions, social questions, economic questions. What does the Tzitz represent? The mind, holiness, learning, sacredness, ritual questions, Yoredeya, Orechayim, Ebenezer. And the great Rabbanim we have to turn to for guidance, both for the Tzitz and the Choshen Mishpat. We have to turn for guidance on all ritual questions and all practical questions. And the Rav alludes to an issue in this Hesped that was very real. No, what did your grandparents tell you about the late 1930s? Netanyahu. Do you boycott Hitler? Do you demonstrate against Hitler? By 1938, we knew what Hitler was up to. Big demonstrations were held, 38, 39. They took Madison Square Garden. My parents attended. You couldn't get in. The entire garden was filled. Tens of thousands were outside. Boycott declared against Hitler. Agudat Yisrael, the great Rabbanim said, Chas v'chalila, you'll just get him more angry. Shtat lanut, not the boycott. And Rav Chaim Iser was against boycotting. And against public demonstrations. And the Rav alludes on issues, boycott or not the boycott, we also have to follow the Das Torah of Rav Chaim Iser, of the Choshen Mishpat. You with me, Danny? What an agudist presentation. What a hesped. The Rav, following the lead of Reb Lazer Silva, 100% in the Aguda camp. Parentheses and brackets, the Rabban Lichtenstein said this in public on his hesped for the Rav. He changed his mind on this topic, and of course, what was the great catalyst in the Rav's becoming a Mizrahiite? World War II. And here, with my own ears, and I'll come to this when we speak about Das Torah, I still remember when Rav Meir Kahana started demonstrating against the communists, against Russia. JBL, he turned JBL into a major Russian anti-Russian organization. So one of the early demonstrations had to be the mid-50s. So after class, one of the fellas asked the Rav, and you know, we who were close to the Rav, we didn't get up till the Rav left the room. We would be sitting, you know, after Shia, a lot of fellas ran out. We'd still bother Rebbe, wanted to hear the give and take, questions, whatever. And then we'd walk him across the street to his mother's apartment. We would walk him across Amsterdam Avenue, right across the street. So a fellow, I don't remember who it was, and he says, Rebbe, should we demonstrate against the Russians? And the Rav says, we should make the same mistake we made, that we didn't demonstrate against Hitler? And he absolutely said yes. Later, the Rav said, you have to get expert opinion if the demonstrations help or don't help. I'll deal with all this. I'll give you sources. But very fascinating. I didn't realize at the time how dramatic and how important the Rav's answer was. Should we make the same mistake that we didn't demonstrate against Hitler? And there's no question that the tragedy of World War II, the impotence of the Jewish community in America, the ability of the State Department to stifle us and keep it a secret and get Stephen Weiss not to say a word in public, even though they knew millions of Jews were being killed. Never again. And the Rav many, many times came back to this thing, Al-Chayt, you know, I write about it, and then the Rav said we should compose a new Al-Chayt for Yom Kippur. Al-Chayt shechatanu lefanefesh ha-shamanu et kol tzakat achenu be'erapa v'lo asinu dai, v'lo asinu maspik, quote, end quote. But what a hesper at that time. And Agudistim are right. It was more Agudistim hesper than any other talk ever given in America. And it's known in full today, the tzitz and the choshen. And whenever a Jewish observer wanted to quote the Rav, they would quote from this hesped, which is intellectually dishonest, because you have to make clear, if you're quoting in the 1970s, the 1980s, the 1990s, that there's an addendum, that the Rav revised his position in later years. Yes, Michael?
Does that include being against sovereignty?
Was the Rav against Jewish sovereignty in 1939? I can't, in 1940 or 41, I can't answer. He didn't speak about it in public. But I'll deal with that, if not today, I'll deal with that next week. You'll see. I'll deal with it, not about the Rav, but about Agudat Yisrael. But I can't answer. He never addressed it. I have to assume that by 1939, he was not against Jewish sovereignty, but we'll talk about that next week. Okay? Let me just go one step further and conclude. Gentlemen, the convention in 1940 was tremendously successful, but more important, by 41, a whole slew of Gedolei Yisrael were in America, including Rav Aaron Cutler. With the coming of Rav Aaron Cutler, the entire history of American Torah is altered, is changed, is intensified. Rav Aaron was a dynamo. Like all short people, and there must be a lot of research on this, short people moved the world, changed the world. They called it a Napoleon complex. I don't know if that's totally correct, but there may be a lot of truth to it. You take Joseph H. Lookstein, he was all of 5'3". When I interviewed him, I had to look down at him, and I'm not particularly tall. What an individual. Built Ramaz, built KJ. You take Rabbi Steve Riskin. How tall is Rabbi Riskin? 5'5"? I don't know. What a dynamo. Chaim Soloveitchik said, among my father's Talmidim, he is the biggest builder. Absolutely. There's no one who comes close to him. Short people. Rabbi Aaron Cutler, how tall is he? 5'3", 5'4". Revolutionized the world. 1941, there's another convention. This time it's in Baltimore. But this time, Rabbi Aaron Cutler's there. Rabbi Ruben Grzybski, the son-in-law of Rabbi Baruch Ber Leibovich, The tells the Rosh Yeshiva, Rav Michael Katz, Rav Blach, Rav Elia Meir Blach, the Novadika Rosh Yeshiva, Rav Yafin is there. It's in Rav Mendel Zaks of Rotten, the Chabad Chaim son-in-law later, the Bochein NYU. And in 1947, they appoint for the first time in America a Moetzet Gedolei HaTorah. There's now an international one, and for the first time, an American Moetzet. Chair people, Reb Aaron Cutler, Reb Blazer Silva, and Reb Shlomo Hyman. Members, names that you know, Reb Moshe Feinstein, Reb Mendel Zaks, the Biyana Rebbe, and above all, a young man from Boston, member of the first Moetzet Gedolei HaTorah in the United States, Reb Yosef Dov Halevi Soloveitchik. And let me end off with a true story right from this classroom. Occasionally people wander in here. I call them voyagers or sightseers. All right. This is a kid years ago, very brilliant kid. He's learning in Eish HaTorah. Or Ar Sameach, I believe it was, not Eish, Ar Sameach. And he had been listening to shirm of mine, and he decides to attend in person. And whatever was, if you read the souvenir I mentioned in class, Rav Yosef Dov Halevi Soloveitchik, a member of the Moetzet Gedolei HaTorah, 1941. So he mentions it to his Rebbe in Ar Sameach. And the Rebbe, in typical fashion for some of that school of thought, can it be? Rakefet doesn't know what he's talking about. Impossible. The Gedolei Yisrael wouldn't have sat with him. And he, emachtashim blata, from what my Talmud said to him. So the boy comes back to me, and he says, challenges me, what's your source? So I go into my office, I pull out the silver era, go to the footnote, give him Harpades, Rabbinic Journal, give him the exact year and page. No, most Talmidim, you do that, it ends there. He said to me, where can you get Harpades? Could be it's online today, I don't know. But at that time I told him, you got to go to the National Library, Hebrew University, to the periodical room. Do you know the kid went there, Xeroxed it, brought it back to Ar Sameach, showed it to his Rebbe. All right, I haven't seen him in a few years. I saw him in Florida. He was doing postgraduate work. He's a Talmid Chacham, Yirei Shamayim. But one thing I can tell you, he's not in the Haredi world today. That Rebbe pushed him away. And wow, I couldn't get over it. How someone can say, cannot be, Rakefet doesn't know what he's talking about. Facts are facts. Life is life. Honesty is honesty. As a Talmud of the Rav, I hate to say it, but I think the Rav got more upset if a student had intellectual dishonesty than if he did a sin. You understand? All right, a sin, you can do tshuva, but intellectual dishonesty shows there's a certain fault in your very personality. It's very deep. It's very frightening. Intellectual dishonesty as a Talmud of the Rav, there's nothing that pushes me away more than intellectual dishonesty. Right? We can have difference of opinion, but honest we have to be. Gentlemen, all right, I'm proud of today's shiur. We did a world. I started with the Kovet Igrot of the Chazon Ish, and I stand, it bothers me, it troubles me, because I feel bad that I spoke with Reb Heschel Schachter and I told him the story, and I told him Reb Shmuel Pick has to be right if they have a manuscript, but no one has seen the manuscript. They refuse to show it. And the more I think about it, and who behulo mizrachi bolet on Rav Kahneman, it doesn't even get off the floor to write a sentence like that. So in my humble opinion, unless I'm proven wrong, my intellectual deciphering of the document tells me the Rav was right, and the document is about the Rav. Okay, we went into the Kenisya Gedolah 1923, 1929, 1937. The link between 1937 to America, we'll talk about it next week, but you can understand yourself that as a result of Reb Leizer Silva going, he brought back, as given a bren, you should say, a bren. How do you say that in English? I don't know. It was like a bren means like a fire, but it doesn't translate well.
Fire in the belly.
What would you say?
Fire in the belly.
Fire in the belly, Reb Leizer, wow. And he went to work. He went to work. And take a look what he accomplished. And never forget that second Kenisya Gedolah in Cincinnati, the reform went crazy. They called that gooder a sickly weed. I have a quote in my book, in the Subira, a sickly weed that has been transplanted from Europe. And take a look what came out of it, and look now, you have a Moesek Gedolei HaTorah, and the Rav, a total Agudist, and then of course, World War II comes in, Shem Yirachem Oleinu. Just let me mention, next week in the Sunday class, you'll be bowled away, the first Shiloh we're going to deal with next week comes out of Nashville, Tennessee. And then you'll see the Minchat Yitzchak, we'll see Rabbi Vadya. It's a fascinating world. You'll see Tel Aviv, you'll see Buenos Aires, you'll see the wedding Shaila, and just two worlds dancing with each other, a tango between Ashkenazim and Sfardim and interlocking. And all right, Baruch Hashem, I love what we said yesterday, what we saw in the Tshuva, Lishonot. Isn't that a beautiful description of reality? Walk the streets of Jerusalem, and how many different languages do you hear? In this class, we'll pick up exactly where we left off. Michael, do me a favor, give this to Yitzchak. It's from Rav Asher Weiss. If anyone needs a calendar, they're giving them away wholesale, evidently overprinted. Again, the beautiful article in here on this Mr. Rucker from Chicago, and this is in Marin, and the talks in so beautiful what the man has done with the money. He's a graduate, he's an American who studied in Merkaz Aram, the study he does, and I love the story of the $1,000 bagel. That is a beautiful story that you can tell and retell, that he sits down in Chicago, this guy just comes down in Israel, comes from Israel, he takes him to breakfast, and they order bagels and lox, and while he's eating, the word goes out who's eating in the bagel place, and person after person comes over with a sad story, gives this guy $100, another $100, $100. By the time it's over, the bagel costs him a few thousand dollars. If anyone wants it, the bakasha. The article on Rav Yashiv has appeared in last week's Shabbos edition of Yisrael Hayom. It's from 2810. It is a beautiful article on Rebbe Yashiv. It is very, very sensitive. And I have to give credit to a secular paper. It's not exactly, you know, a religious paper. It's the freebie paper, but it's a general newspaper. It's a beautiful article on Rebbe Yashiv. Until we meet again in health and happiness, Das Vedanya.